Dublin.
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. In the studio today, I have special guest Simon Franklin, composer of Avatar Way of Water and the recent Avatar Fire and Ash. Actually, I can hear my echo.
Oh, a second. Let me see what I can do to with you. I can, let me, I can always wear headphones if you want. Would that be better?
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film. I don't hear myself anymore.
Okay. Unless I can put those on and see. Right. Just try talking at me now.
All right. I'm saying words. I'm going to be hosting.
Okay. And now I'm talking at you. Is that should be considerably better.
Yes, I can hear you well.
Great. Okay, good. Right, let's go for it now.
Here we go. Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. In the studio today, I have special guest Simon Franklin, composer of Avatar Way of Water and the recent Avatar Fire and Ash, amongst many other projects. Thank you so much for being here with me at Dublab, Simon.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very glad to be able to do this.
Wonderful. Well, first off, let me congratulate you on having your score shortlisted for the Oscars for Best Original Score. Congratulations. How is that for you?
It's really nice. I like the fact that other composers actually liked the music that I wrote. And that obviously is good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, congratulations. Before we get into your work on Avatar, I wanted to learn more about your work in the recording industry. So I read that you've worked on albums by Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, of course, Celine Dion. I want to know, how did you first work your way into those recording spaces?
I sort of knew exactly what I was going to do from when I was 13. I just walked into my school, had a theater, and in the theater was a tape recorder and a mixing desk. And it literally was like the light went on and I wrote to the BBC and said, how do I become a record producer? And they then said, oh, you have to do all these things. And I was going to do a music degree instead. I then moved to doing electronics because that's what the BBC told me I needed to do. But I was just obsessed with recording in general. And I went to university up in Manchester. Manchester at the time was the home of bands like New Order and those things. There was a legendary club called the Hacienda, for which I was member number 437. And I used to go and see all of these bands. I used to go out all the time. I came, left university, went straight down to London, went into a tiny recording studio and persuaded the guy. I was just recording some demos for myself, but I persuaded the guy who owned the studio that he needed a studio manager. I got paid the princely sum of £25 a week to run the studio, but I could record my own stuff when other people weren't there. And they bought one of the early music computers. It was the thing called a PPG Wave and Waveterm. I was obsessed with what I could do with it. It was like, oh, this was my Steinway. I mean, I've got a piano here behind me, but there's something about the way that I use computers and music in general. I don't think at all. It's entirely intuitive and natural for me. Somebody saw me using this thing and persuaded a guy called Trevor Horn, who was a big record producer at the time, said, you should see this kid. And Trevor hired me to be his Synclavier programmer. I'd never worked on a Synclavier before. So on December the 4th, I took away all the manuals, which were literally a wall of this stuff, learned everything I could. And on January the 5th, I was thrown into a studio with Yes, who were the biggest band in the world at the time, and had to start and work at that point. So the studio is my home. I wasn't a live musician. I've done one tour and it drove me batty because playing the same piece of music again every night would just go around in my head. And I love the investigation of the new, and I love the challenges because the curiosity gene just runs deep. And so from doing records in London, at some point I was producing records, independent records in London and stuff. An American engineer and producer saw me working, said, you have to come to LA, because nobody programs quite like you. And I came to LA and realized, A, I had to go back to school again. Secondly, I found a niche, which was there were people who were phenomenal pianists. There were the great, the Randy Kerbers, the Ralph Grierson's of this world. And then there were some computer programmer people, but they were good with the technology. I had this niche, which is I was a good enough player to be vaguely okay, dangerous, but I was astonishingly good in their terms, in terms of the way that I could use electronica and synths and samplers, and I could build entire tracks in comparison to what was available in Los Angeles at the time. And so I started working initially with a guy called David Foster. I was doing all his records and we started having a lot of success, and it was pretty rapid. And then I started getting hired by other people and spread out. That's sort of been the journey.
Wow, that's incredible. Do you still find yourself tinkering with technology and electronics as it kind of moves forward in time?
Oh, yeah. That's my, inverted commas, hobby, but I'm obsessed with where you can take audio technology, especially with immersive audio and 3D sound and what you can do there. And I advise some companies on the use of audio technology to bring the best out of music.
Mm. Excellent. So what did you learn by working in the recording industry that you carry into the film composing space?
The thing that I think people enjoyed, why I was did well as a player, one of the things was I had a groove and people enjoyed my groove. And And so I did an awful lot of records where I was doing all the drum programming, all the synths, all the stuff like that. So because it would be something, you say a song like Unbreak My Heart or whatever, the groove on that is entirely something that I would program up in the synclavier and the synths. But that sense of head bob is it really a thing. Once you get people to do this, everything else goes with them. And I've carried that, I think, into my writing. If you listen to the scores, hopefully, even on the action cues, always groove. They may have unusual grooves. They may have 7/8s. They may 5/4s. They may be all over the shop. But there will be a sense of, if I can get your backside and your head moving, then everything else will follow, I hope. And that tends to be, an approach that I've brought from the record side of me.
Well, I definitely feel like the tracks that I listen to, especially the one that opened the show, Wind Traders, I thought that has a very good groove, a great motion to it and everything like that. I want to talk about, before I keep avoiding Avatar because we're going to dive into it, but I need to talk about Moulin Rouge because it's one of my all-time favorite films. And so I want to know, working on this film, I can imagine there was so much music involved and, you know, there's so much going on. I can't even imagine what the production of it was like, but did it feel as grand when in the making of than as it turned out to be in the theater?
I came in a bit later. They'd been shooting and filming in New Zealand, Australia. They'd been filming in Australia. They came back to LA and they asked me, I did two major roles. One was to produce a couple of the songs. So I did Come What May with David Foster and I was, but the main thing was getting the vocals to really feel great. It was, they had stuff they'd done in Australia and they asked me to come in and I would work with Nicole and the others to really get those vocals so that you really believed and connected with them. And I think that was, if I can take some pride in it, is the fact that when you hear her sing, Someday I'll Fly Away, that you feel the great acting that she brought, but you also feel a great vocal performance. And it would be the same with all of the other that I was sort of brought in. I would work with the other characters as well. They come over to my studio here in Hollywood, and then we would just go through and I would try and get to the point where the performances were at what we would consider record level, that you could put this on as an album and be extreme, that they would be, as artists, proud of the vocals that they delivered. Because I thought it was really essential that for this, we have such a connection with some of these songs with phenomenal vocals on the originals. And therefore, especially for Nicole, because they were not easy songs to sing. Mm-hmm. You know, the song, you know, you have, you want to make sure that connected. So I'm very proud of the work on that one.
Well, great work. I mean, again, it's one of my favorite films. When it was in the theaters, I watched it a million times. I actually worked in a movie theater as it was in theaters, and I remember just watching it from the projector room as much as I could. So I was obsessed with that movie. And I was excited to see it on your resume. All right, let's go into Avatar. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, I played the track The Wind Traders from Avatar Fire and Ash. Next, I'm going to play the song, the original song, Dream Is One. I know you're a producer on My Heart Will Go On, earning you a Grammy Award. And now you're a co-writer on Dream Is One, performed by Miley Cyrus. So we're going to listen to the song, and then we're going to talk about it. Here is Dream Is One.
Our love will never fade away. We're diamonds in the dark. I put my head against your chest and listen to your heart. 'Cause you are my home, no matter where. Song to keep this love alive. maybe when we dream, we dream as one.
So tell me about your role in this song and what you feel you bring as an artist to original songs in films.
Well, obviously, I've got a bit of heritage here. It goes back, and I used to work on a lot of record, end of film things, like Because You Love Me for Celine, which was, you know, like number one for ages, that Diane Warren wrote. You know, there was a lot of these things, and obviously The Bodyguard, when my first big stuff was working on those Whitney Houston tracks. And there is something about a great song that you hopefully, when they're done right, and I would think that James Horner's and Will Jennings' My Heart Will Go On, which I'm very, you know, I can remember when James brought me the piano sketch and said, here is My Heart Will Go On. Those songs tell you a story that makes you connect and feel like they have given you, they've tied you into the film emotionally. And I had looked at the film and I thought the beginning and the end of Fire and Ash are about connection. They are about, we open the film with Loak and Dateon flying together in the spirit world. We don't know they're in the spirit world, but then there's this point there, there's that connection there. And then at the end of the film, we have Spider going into the spirit world, and we see this sense of a connection. Eventually, as the camera pans out, you see these tendrils of light going across the planet as that sense of the connection between everybody is joined. And I wanted that sense of connection. And I had a title and some rough ideas, which I, around, I want to say April, May, I had a title called We Dream as One. And I thought that was there. And maybe a couple of months later, Jim said to me, what do you think about Miley singing the song? And he and Miley had both been given Disney Legends Awards and he'd said to her once, hey, we should work together one day. So he said, what do you think? Do you think Miley would be a good choice for the end of the film? And I phoned up two friends, Andrew Wyatt and Mark Ronson. And I knew they'd worked with her. And so I go, oi, what do you think? Do you think she'd be interested? And 10 minutes later, I get a text back from Andrew. She's in. And Andrew and Mark then came to the Manhattan Beach Studios where Jim Shoes Lightstorm is based. And we showed them the film. Then they came back to my studio here. Andrew Wyatt lives up the street from me, literally up the street. Mm. He's at that point, if his car's brakes failed, he would crash into my studio. And they came down to my studio. I played them a load of some ideas, and we talked about concepts behind the song and how it should be done. I handed it over to them because I had to then go to New Zealand to work with Jim Cameron on the score. There was still the other 3 hours and 4 minutes and 16 seconds that had to be dealt with. Right. And they started working with Miley in LA, and they would send me things and say, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And gradually that they would send me more and more stuff. I would then send them, say, what about adding these strings here? What about if we put voices there? And at the end, we had something that I think connects with the film, that makes you feel like there is that connection that's important. Miley talked about the fact that she had her house had burned down a few years ago. And she remembered picking out her belongings out of the ashes. And that is part of what the lyric is there, is about that idea of rebirth. And I think that the song hopefully has that connection. I'm very proud of it.
Wonderful. Well, it's a beautiful song, and you know, again, also Oscar shortlisted, so It's an exciting time for the film overall. And when it comes to the score to Avatar Fire and Ash, I understand that you designed Navi indigenous instruments and had them 3D printed to be performed on the score. I want to hear about what that's all about. Like, how did you come up with the concept or even know what the instruments would sound like? And, you know, if you could just walk me through that.
There's a scene on when we see the Wind Traders. There's a point when they're actually having a jig on one of their ships, and there's a fire going on. They're having a dance. We call it the Wind Traders jig. And 2018, the Wind Traders need to jig for live capture for the actors and the musicians who are going to be there. Now, the problem is that they are going to be not just singing and clapping. They're going to be playing instruments. Now, the Na'vi are 10 feet tall, 3 meters tall, and they have four fingers and an opposable thumb, but their fingers are much longer. So three fingers and an opposable thumb. So they only have four digits in total. They are more, they sort of, you know, they're obviously much taller and much more, their limbs are longer. So I had to design instruments for them. And also I wanted to design them for the culture of the Wind Traders. One of the things that we do in Avatar is we have a thing called Culture Club. And Culture Club is me, Deb Scott, the costume designer, Dylan Cole, and the production designers. Sometimes we get the Ben Proctor as well, who does all the human side of things. They split the job up. So there's one guy who oversees all of the organic Na'vi. There's another guy who does all of the guns and boats and all of the stuff like that. Every so often he comes on. And the prop master, and we have two research people who would come in and help us as well. And I looked at the Wind Traders, and we sort of defined the culture in Culture Club. And I realized, well, okay, one of the things that you have is the instruments need to reflect how they are. First of all, they're nomads. They travel around. So these instruments have to be able to be easily transportable. They have to also probably reflect their culture. I'm using instruments for the Ash, which are, I use these things called Murin Hurs, which are Mongolian nomadic string instruments, which I've got one. You can't see it on radio. But in reality, at the radio, that you would see a horse's head on the end of this. And the point about the horse's head is that's Mongolian culture is based around the horse. So I decided the Wind Traders culture would be based around, for instance, the rigging on the ships and so on. So I made the string instruments so that I looked at things like the kora from West Africa. I turned it upside down. I made the resonant bowl there. It would catch on my shoulder there. And I made the strings so that they could be played this way. And then I made a thing more like a mutant birimbau, which is something that you see a lot in certain African cultures as well. And I made a version of that that would be Na'vi-sized. But then I have to actually have musicians play them live on set, because the point about Avatar is we don't animate. It's always, if somebody does it, it's performance capture. So we had performers, we had drummers, and we had musicians who were going to be there to be captured playing these instruments. So they had to be playable. I'd made the drum skins. We took the drum skins and we used the same material that we used for the rigging, for the sails of the ship. And if you look around, you will see these instruments, for instance, a lot of them. When we first meet the Wind Traders, there's a great big bazaar where they're buying and selling things, and you will see the instruments dotted around. And so we used the instruments, we captured them, but then you have to have a 3D, I sketched them. Then the art department made beautiful versions. Then my prop master, Brad Elliott, then printed them in 3D so human-sized actors and musicians could play them. And the last step is that I recorded those instruments and used them in the score.
Incredible. Just the creative process of that is fascinating, because it's obviously not something that you're asked to do on just any film. And the idea that you are given the space to even do that, that you're not rushed through the process, that you're not told, don't do that, you know, just use existing acoustic instruments or whatever. It's amazing. I love it.
Welcome to Jim Cameron world.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to another piece from the score. This piece is going to be titled "I Am the Fire." There's often a lot of vocalists used in the score for Avatar films. And I want to know, could you talk about conceptually how you decide like what the singers are going to vocalize, Navi language? Is it just ooh, ah? I'm just very curious about the actual kind of tribal sound we hear in the score.
In general, if there's Navi singing of sorts, it's in Navi. So that, for instance, when the Wind Traders jig, we hear a bit of it. They're actually singing Dance with the Wind and so on. And there's a whole lyric in Navi that is about them. And that is part of their vocal. If you hear the Ash singing, they have an Ash ceremony. They're singing fire, fire, burn, burn, and so on. And all of the times, the lyrics in the Navi things are always appropriate to what's going on or to the culture. I think that's you might as well, if you're going to go the whole way, you really need to get there. Problem with this is that Navi is a hideous language to sing. It has K's and X's and T's. So getting the right words is always an interesting part of the process. But there's a couple of other corollaries to this, which is that, for instance, I don't use voices for the humans. So when we meet the baddies, when we meet the RDA, when we do Quaritch, when we have all the things, there aren't voices ever used for any of the human side. Mm. The voices are there to tell you about the connection with the Navi. They're there to give you a sense of the planet and the place. And the humans are the invaders. I want them to be metallic. I want them to have that sense of that they are the destructors of culture rather than inheriting them. And the voice is an important thing because it's the simplest way of connecting for us as in terms of, you put a voice anywhere, your ear goes to it, which means it's a color that a lot of directors avoid because it's a very strong color. Jim loves what it can do. And we had a tradition of using some vocals in A1. And I've continued that, but I've evolved the cultural sound. So for instance, A1, we had a very clipped, quite abrupt sound that for the Avatar 1. Avatar 2, we go and meet the Reef clan. So I went to the South Pacific, to the Polynesian Islands and the South Pacific. I got a choir together from Vanuatu and the Cook Islands and recorded them in Wellington. And they had a softer, more lyrical tone, and that's what the Metkayina's vocal tone is. The Ash is more based on, it's more a chant, and that's based on, there's the Kachek monkey chant you may have seen, and it was, I thought, oh, that's got something about it. It's a vocalization rather than it having a tune, a melody. The Ash don't have themes, they have feelings. There is one exception, which is, well, you just played it, which is Varong. And so Varong, she is the enchantress. She is she is the sort of like, she has this ability to control people. And I wanted to get that vocally. So I gave her a theme, which is a simple thing that flows around your head. I put three voices and I pitched them all against each other. Problem was getting singers to sing out of tune. So I manipulated them so they're moving in and out, but they actually go around your head in Atmos, if you listen to it in Atmos. The idea being that she is weaving the spell, and what you've heard just there in I Am the Fire, there's a point where you hear it on the flute, and that's the wonderful Pedro Eustache starting, and then the voices appear along with the textures that I created for the Ash, which is the more in her texture.
Mm.
And so the cue is sort of like, if you want, it's at a pivotal moment in the film. And so we start, it goes from those weird aleatoric strings at the beginning when Quaritch collapses. Then we have Varong telling the story of how the Ash came into being, how their civilization was destroyed by a volcano. And then they turn their back on the civilization. The Ash I looked at as being the punks of this world. I was a wannabe punk when I was little, and I wasn't brave enough to put safety pins through my cheek, but I hung out with the ones who did. And The thing about punk was that punk was a response to British society at the time, that they felt like the society had turned its back on them and they were going to turn their back on society. The Ash is very much that same vibe. This anarchy and destruction, they want to tear AWR down, and I wanted them to have that feeling. And the feeling I made is by using these Moorenher strings was that dun, 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 dun. And that's under the Queen Enchantress as she's singing her thing. I mean, she's like sort of taking Quaritch through a drug trip. You can see his eyes going like completely out, his pupils dilate rapidly, and he's looking and seeing all these textures coming. And then gradually she tells the story, and then we think she's got her knife out, we think she's got fully in control. And then there's a point where everything changes, where he goes, I came here for you, and I bring in Quaritch's theme on low brass. And actually, visually, if you look at the film, you'll see his pupils change. They go from being utterly dilated to being absolutely pin tight and normal. And he talks about a future of them together. And there's a point when she then starts saying that she listens to him, and then she says, I see you. Quaritch says, damn right you do. And then Jim gave me the ability to have no dialogue, no sound effects, just the loudest kick drum I could possibly make, and these synths. And then that's the point where it transforms, and we go outside, and she is suddenly presented with the tools of her victory, which is the flamethrower and the guns. And you see this transformation of them, and gradually she feels the power of flame and fire, and the Moorenhers are going down, dun, 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 which they're joined to with the orchestra. And then gradually Quaritch's theme, which I play on brass, joins underneath. And we end up with what Jim calls the power couple from hell as we go to the end. And that's that cue I'm extremely proud of, because I think it tells a story.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, and also, we talked about the native instruments you created, the Navi instruments. I mean, I know there's also over 100 pieces in the orchestra. I was curious, is there an instrument that's not used in the Avatar score?
I'm not sure. I do about most of the big cues have 1,000 tracks, because I go back to my day job. And so the rhythmic side of things is almost universally me playing all the grooves and the synth work. And there's part of my sound is layering, so that I will often play things. But because I started with a sequencer with a door that didn't have cut and paste, I was used to playing things beginning to the end of a song. If I was playing a hi-hat on something, I would play it from the beginning to the end, and it would evolve with me playing. And that became my style. Now with something like Avatar, if I've got a sound, if I've got a drum thing, I will often play 10 different tracks of drums and play them individually on top of each other, so that the sound is always feeling like it organically evolved. It always feels like there's evolution going on, mm-hmm. and that it isn't just a static loop. Nature abhors repetition in that form, where it's just something where the in cinema, what happens is you end up, if you're not careful, with wallpaper. And you actually want to have something that flows underneath the dialogue, underneath the sound effects. And I find that my style has always been to program manually, play things from beginning to the end, so that they evolve. And by putting different textures on top of each other and layering, even a simple bass drum will have a variation built into it, so that your ear understands that there's something going on that just keeps it feeling as if it has a reason. Everything else is changing. So the sounds can do this thing. They can be organic. They can groove. But the groove has feel, has a humanity to it that I think doesn't happen when you cut and paste.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. That's amazing. I can't believe we're at the end of the program already, but I got to ask you my question I ask of all my guests. And that question is, what was the first album you purchased, and what was the last thing you listened to?
The first album I purchased, I think it might have been, yes, Close to the Edge, but the first single I purchased was the next record I bought, which had more of an interest to me, which was New Rose by The Damned. And literally my life transformed with New Rose. The last thing I listened to, I want to say, oh God, I think it's called Somni. I was listening to the new Snarky Puppy album, which I
Oh,
think sounds phenomenal. I'm an enormous fan of Snarky Puppy.
very cool. Very cool. Well, I'm so glad you could join me on Studio Soundtracks only on DubLab Radio. Listeners can find the original motion picture soundtrack to Avatar: Fire and Ash on their streaming platform of choice. And if you miss the film in theaters, it's bound to appear on Disney Plus in the coming months, so don't miss it. Simon, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me, Chanda.
Oh.